Other fiction. The hair. He worked at it with his tongue for a while, then sat up in bed and began picking at it with his fingers. Outside, it was going to be a nice day, and some birds were singing. He tore off a corner of the matchbook and scraped in between his teeth. Nothing. He could still feel it. He ran his tongue over his teeth again from back to front, stopping when he got to the hair. He touched all around it, then stroked it with his tongue where it threaded in between two of the front teeth, followed it in an inch or so to the end and smoothed it against the roof of his mouth. He touched it with his finger. Ugh, Christ. What's the matter? His wife asked, sitting up. We oversleep? What time is it? I've got something in my teeth. Can't get it out. I don't know. Feels like a hair. He went into the bathroom and glanced at the mirror, then washed his hands and face with cold water. He turned on the shaving lamp over the mirror. I can't see it, but I know it's there. If I could just get hold of it, maybe I could pull it out. His wife came into the bathroom, scratching her head and yawning. You get it, honey? He ground his teeth together, squeezed his lips down against his teeth until his fingernails broke the skin. Just a minute, let me see it, she said, moving closer. He stood under the light, mouth open, twisting his head back and forth, wiping his pajama sleeve over the glass as it fogged up. I don't see anything, she said. Well, I can feel it. He turned off the light and started running water in the tub. The hell with it. Forget it. I've got to get ready for work. He decided to walk downtown since he didn't want any breakfast and still had plenty of time to get to work. Nobody had a key except the boss, and if he got there too early, he'd only have to wait. He walked by the empty corner where he usually caught the bus. A dog he'd seen around the neighborhood before had his leg cocked, pissing on the bus stop sign. Hey. The dog quit pissing and came running over to him. Another dog that he didn't recognize came trotting up, sniffed at the sign, and pissed. Golden, slightly steaming as it ran down the sidewalk. Hey, get out of here. The dog squirted a few more drops, then both dogs crossed the street. They almost looked like they were laughing. He threaded the hair back and forth through his teeth. Nice day now, isn't it, huh? The boss asked. He opened the front door, raised the shade. Everyone turned to look back outside and nodded, smiling. Yes, it is, sir, just a beautiful day, someone said. Too nice to be working, someone else said, laughed with the others. Yes, it is. It is at that, the boss said. He went on up the stairs to open up boys' clothing, whistling, jingling his keys. Later on, when he came up from the basement and was taking his break in the lounge, smoking a cigarette, the boss came in wearing a short-sleeved shirt. Hot today, isn't it, huh? Yes, it is, sir. He'd never noticed before that the boss had such hairy arms. He sat picking his teeth, staring at the thick tufts of black hair that grew in between the boss's fingers. Sir, I was wondering. If you don't think I can, that's all right, naturally. But if you think so, without putting anybody in a bind, I mean, I'd like to go home. I don't feel so well. Well, we can make it all right, of course. That's not the point, of course. He took a long drink of his Coke, kept looking at him. Well, then, that's all right, then, sir. I'll make it. I was just wondering. No, that's all right now. You go on home. Call me up tonight. Let me know how you are. He looked at his watch, finished his Coke. 10:25. Say 10:30. Go on home now. We'll call it 10:30. Out in the street, he loosened his collar and began to walk. He felt strange walking around town with a hair in his mouth. He kept touching it with his tongue. He didn't look at any of the people he met. In a little while, he began to sweat under his arms and could feel it dripping through the hair into his undershirt. Sometimes he stopped in front of the showroom windows and stared at the glass, opening and closing his mouth, fishing around with his finger. He took the long way home, down through the Lions Club Park, where he watched the kids play in the wading pool and paid 15 cents to an old lady to go through the little zoo and see the birds and animals. Once, after he had stood for a long time looking through the glass at the giant Gila monster, the creature opened one of its eyes and looked at him. He backed away from the glass and went on walking around the park until it was time to go home. He wasn't very hungry and only drank some coffee for supper. After a few swallows, he rolled his tongue over the hair again. He got up from the table. "Honey, what's the matter?" his wife asked. "Where are you going?" "I think I'm going to go to bed. I don't feel so well." She followed him into the bedroom, watched while he undressed. "Can I get you something? Maybe I should call the doctor? I wish I knew what was the matter."
"That's all right. I'll be all right."
He pulled up the covers over his shoulders and turned over, closing his eyes. She pulled the shade. "I'll straighten up the kitchen a little, then I'll be back." It felt better just to stretch out. He touched his face and thought he might have a fever. He licked his lips and touched the end of the hair with his tongue. He shivered. After a few minutes, he began to doze, but woke suddenly and remembered about calling the boss. He got slowly out of bed and went out to the kitchen. His wife was at the draining board doing dishes. "I thought you were asleep. Honey, you feel better now?" He nodded, picked up the phone, and got information. He had a kind of bad taste in his mouth as he dialed.
"Hello. Yes, sir, I think I feel better. Just wanted you to know I'll be at work tomorrow."
"Right. 8:30 sharp."
After he got back in bed, he smoothed his tongue over his teeth again. Maybe it was just something he could get used to. He didn't know. Just before he went to sleep, he'd almost stopped thinking about it. He remembered what a warm day it had been and those kids out waiting, how the birds were singing that morning. But once during the night, he yelled out and woke up sweating, almost choking. "No, no," he kept saying, kicking his feet against the covers. It scared his wife, and she didn't know what was the matter. The Aficionados. They are sitting in the shade at a small iron patio table, drinking wine out of heavy metal cups.
"Why should you feel this way now?" he asks her.
"I don't know," she says. "It always makes me sad when it comes. It's been such a short year, and I don't even know any of the others." She leans forward and reaches for his hand, but he is too quick for her. "They seem so unprofessional." From her lap, she takes her napkin and wipes her lips in a way that has become detestable to him this last month. "We won't talk about it anymore," she says. "We still have 3 hours yet. We won't even think about it." He shrugs and looks past her towards the open windows with their blanket-like squares of white sky, out into the street, taking it all in. Dust covers the low, powdery buildings and fills the street.
"What will you wear?"
he asks, not turning around. "How can you talk about it so?" She slumps back in her chair, interlacing her fingers, twisting the lead ring around her index finger. There are no other patrons on the patio, and in the street nothing moves. "I'll probably wear white as usual, but I might not." "I won't." He smiles, then drains his cup, tasting at the bottom the almost bitter pieces of soft leaves that touch against his lips.
"Should we go?"
He pays for the wine and counts out an additional 5,000 pesos to the shopkeeper.
"This is for you."
The old woman hesitates, looks at the younger woman, and then with a bird-like frightened movement, scrabbles up the bills and pushes them, crinkling, into a front pocket.
"Gracias."
She bows stiffly and respectfully touches her forehead. The patio is dark and has a smell like rotting wood. There are squat black arches encircling it, and one of these opens onto the street. It is noon. The pallid, dead brilliance makes him dizzy for a minute. Heat ripples rise from the adobe walls that close in the narrow street. His eyes water and the air is dry and hot on his face. "Are you all right?" She takes his arm.
"Yes, just a minute."
From a street very close to them, a band is playing. The music streams up and over the roofless buildings,
melting against the heat over his head.
We should see this.
She frowns. It is the same frown she makes when someone tells her there are a few young men interested in the arena nowadays.
If you wish, darling.
I do. Come on. Aren't you going to indulge me on my last afternoon? She clutches his arm tighter and they go slowly down the street in the shade of a low wall, the music moving closer as they near the end of the street. When he was a child, the band used to play several times a year, then twice a year for a long time, and now they play in March only one time in the year. Suddenly the soft, fluffed dust in front of his feet spouts, and he kicks up a brown spider that clings to the toe of his huarache before he kicks it away.
Should we pretend?
He asks. Her eyes have followed the spider, and now they turn to him, flat and gray-filmed, motionless under her damp forehead. Her lips purse.
Pretend?
On an impulse, he kisses her. Her lips are dry and cracked, and he kisses her hard and presses her against the hot brick wall. The band shrieks and clangs and passes across at the end of the street, pauses and moves on, fainter now as it tramps along, then turns off onto another street.
Like it was when we first met and I was a struggling young disciple. You remember?
He remembers anyway. Long hot afternoons at the arena, practicing, practicing, perfecting, every action, every thought, every grace. The blood thrill and rush of excitement as his compadres finished one by one. He was one of the lucky ones and the dedicated. Then he'd moved up at last among the few eligibles, then above them even.
I remember, she says.
This last year as his wife, she might remember, and perhaps she might remember this afternoon. For a moment, he lets himself think about the afternoon.
It was good, it was, she says.
Her eyes are cold and clouded, flat into her face like the eyes of a snake he'd killed once in the mountains in the blind season. They come to the end of the street and stop. It is quiet, and the only sound that reaches them is a dry, rattling, gagging cough coming from somewhere down the street in the direction of the band. He looks at her, and she shrugs before they turn down the street. They walk by some old men sitting in doorways, the doors boarded up behind them, their big dusty sombreros pulled down over their faces, legs drawn up tight and folded against their chests or sticking out into the street. The coughing starts again, dry and thick as if it comes from under the ground, the throat tubed full of dirt. He listens and looks closely at the men. She points into a narrow passageway at a bareheaded small gray man squeezed in between two buildings. The man opens his mouth and makes a cough. He turns her around to him.
How many of us have you lived with?
Why, five or six? I'd have to think. Why do you ask? He shakes his head.
Do you remember Louise?
She pulls her arm out of his, her heavy bracelet making a dull chinking sound. He was my first. I loved him.
He taught me almost everything I needed to know.
He chews on his lip and the sun presses like a hot flat stone on his neck.
Do you remember Jorge?
Yes. They are walking again, and she takes his arm once more. A good man. Like you a little, but I didn't love him. Please, let's not talk about it anymore.
All right. I think I'd like to walk down to the plaza.
Vacant-eyed men and women stare at them as they pass. They sag against the doors or crouch in the dark alcoves and gaze dully at them from low windows. They walk farther, away from the town and out onto the plain. All around them are mortar blocks and chunks of old limed white cement and broken grainy bits and pieces that crush under their feet. Over everything, a thick coat of dust. The plated sun shimmers white and blinding above their heads, burning the garments into their sticky backs. We should go back, she says, squeezing his arm a little.
Pretty soon.
He points at the thin, wash-yellow flowers stretching up from the dark crack of a broken block of cement roadway. They are standing in the Zócalo, the great square,
facing the ruins of the Metropolitan Cathedral. Bordering the square is a line of powdery brown mounds with a single hole in the side of each, facing them. Beyond the mounds, brown rows of adobe houses that run and spread toward the hills until only the tops of the tallest houses are visible. Then a long up and down line of gray humped hills that stretch as far as he can see down the valley. The hills have always reminded him of great-breasted, reclining women, but it all seems strange now and dirty. "Please, love," she says. "Let's go back now and drink a little wine while there's time." From the arena, the band has struck up, a few strains jagging over and across the plain to them. He listens.
"Yes, we mustn't be late."
He looks at the ground and stirs the dust with his heel.
"All right, yes, let's go and have a little wine."
He bends and picks the small cluster of yellow flowers for her. They go to Manuel's, and when Manuel sees them sit down at one of his tables, he first salutes and then goes to the cellar and brings out their last bottle of dark wine.
"You will be at the arena this afternoon, Manuel."
Manuel studies a crack that runs down the length of the wall behind the table.
"See." "Don't feel that way, my friend. It's not so bad. Look."
He tilts his cup and lets the warm wine run down his throat.
"I'm happy. What would be the sense of it if I were not happy? That the moment should be perfect, there should be joy and consent on the part of all persons concerned."
He smiles at him, no hard feelings.
"This is the way it has always been. So you see, I must be happy. And so should you, my friend. We're all in this together."
He finishes another cup and wipes his sweaty palms on his pants. Then he gets up and shakes hands with Manuel.
"We must go. Goodbye, Manuel."
At the entrance to their quarters, she clings to him, whispering and stroking his neck. "I do love you. I love only you." She pulls him to her, her fingers digging into his shoulders, pulling his face to hers, and then she turns and runs for the entrance.
He shouts, "You'll have to hurry if you're going to dress."
Now he is walking in the late afternoon green shadows, and now crossing a deserted square, his sandaled feet settling into the hot, crumbly dirt. For a moment, the sun has gone behind a skein of white clouds, and when he comes onto the street leading to the arena, it is very pale and light, and there are no shadows. Silent, small groups of people shuffle down the street, but they keep their eyes away and show no recognition when he passes them. In front of the arena, a group of dusty men and women is already waiting. They stare at the ground or at the white-laced sky, and a few of them have their mouths open with the backs of their heads almost touching the shoulders, swaying back and forth like ragged stalks of corn as they follow the clouds. He uses a side entrance and goes directly to the dressing room. He lies on the table, his face turned toward the dripping white candle, watching the women. Their distorted, slow movements flicker on the wall as they undress him, rubbing his body with oils and scent before dressing him again in the white, rough-textured garment. Dirt walls close in the narrow room, and there is barely space for the table and the six women who hover over him. A wrinkled, oily brown face peers into his, blowing a wet breath of old food, the breath scraping in her throat. The lips crack farther until they part, open and close over hoarse, ancient syllables. The others pick it up as they help him off the table and lead him into the arena. He lies down quickly on the small platform, closes his eyes and listens to the chanting of the women. The sun is bright against his face, and he turns his head away. The band flares up, much closer, somewhere inside the arena, and for a moment he listens to that. The chanting drops suddenly to a murmur, then stops. He opens his eyes and turns his head first to one side and then to the other. For an instant, all the faces are focused on him, heads craning forward. He closes his eyes to the sight, then the dull chink of a heavy bracelet close to his ear, and he opens his eyes. She is standing over him, dressed in a white robe and holding the long, shiny obsidian knife. She bends closer, the cluster of flowers woven into her hair. Bending lower over his face as she blesses his love and devotion and asks his forgiveness.
Forgive me.
What is the use? He whispers. Then, as the knife point touches his chest, he screams, I forgive you. And the people hear and settle back in their seats, exhausted, as she cuts out his heart and holds it up to the lustrous sun. Poseidon and Company. He saw nothing, only suddenly the wind stiffened and blew mist up off the sea and over his face, taking him by surprise. He'd been dreaming again. Using his elbows, he worked a little closer to the edge that overlooked the beach and raised his face out toward the sea. The wind struck his eyes, bringing tears. Down below, the other boys were playing war, but their voices sounded watery and far away, and he tried not to listen. Over the voices came the squeak of the gulls, out where the sea thundered on the rocks below the temple. Poseidon's temple. He lay again on his stomach and turned his face a little to one side, waiting. On his back, the sun slipped away and a chill broke over his legs and shoulders. Tonight he would lie wrapped in his cover and remember these few minutes of felt time, day fading. It was different than standing in Naiad's cave up in the hills, someone holding his hand under the water that trickled steadily out of the crack in the rock. It had been dripping for no one knows how long, they said. Different, too, than wading in the surf up to his knees, feeling the strange pull. That was time, too, but not the same. They'd told him about that, about when to wade and when to stay off the beach. But this was something of his own, and every afternoon he lay on his stomach up over the sea and waited for the change, the prickly passage of time across his back. Out loud, tasting the sea salt on his lips as he did so, he said a few verses into the wind, new ones that he'd heard last night. Some of the words he liked, he rolled over again in his mouth. Below, he heard Aias curse another boy and invoke one of the gods. Was it true what men told of the gods? He remembered every song he'd heard, every story handed down and recited at night around the fire, as well as all the eyewitness accounts. Still, he had heard some men speak of the gods with disrespect, even disbelief, so that it was hard to know what to believe anymore. Someday he'd leave here and find out for himself. He'd walk over the hills to Eretria, where the trading ships came in. Maybe he'd even be able to board one of them and go wherever it was they go, the places men talked about. Below, the voices were louder and one of the boys was crying jerkily against the clatter of their sticks on the shields. He raised up onto his knees to listen and swayed blindly, dizzy with memory and idea as the evening wind carried up the angry voices. He could hear Achilles yelling loudest of all as the two groups ran back and forth over the beach. Then his own name was called, and he lay down quickly to keep out of sight. Nearer, his sister called again. Now the steps behind him, and he sat up all at once, discovered. There you are, she said. I had to walk all this way for you. Why didn't you come home? You never do anything you're supposed to. She came closer. Give me your hand. He felt her hands take his and begin to pull him. No, he said, shaking. He jerked free, and with the stick he sometimes called spear, began to feel his way down the trail. Well, you'll see, little man who thinks he's so big, she said. Your time's coming, Mama said. Bright red apples.
I can't make water, Mommy, old Hutchins said, coming out of the bathroom with tears in his eyes. Close your barn door, Pa, Rudy shouted. The old man disgusted him and his hand twitched in anger. He leaped out of his chair and looked around for his boomerang. Have you seen my boomerang, Ma? No, I haven't, Mother Hutchins said patiently. Now you just behave yourself, Rudy, while I see to your pa. You just heard him say he can't make water. But close your barn door, Daddy, like Rudy says,
Old Hutchins sniffled, but did as he was told. Mother Hutchins came over to him with a worried look, holding her hands in her apron.
"It's just what Dr. Porter said would happen, Mommy,"
Old Hutchins said, sagging against the wall and looking as if he were going to die right then.
"I'll get up one morning," he said, "and not be able to make water."
"Shut up," Rudy shouted. "Shut up. Talk, 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 dirty talk all day long. I've had enough of it."
"You keep quiet now, Rudy,"
Mother Hutchins said feebly, moving back a step or two with Old Hutchins in her arms. Rudy began stalking up and down the linoleum-covered floor of the sparsely furnished but tidy living room. His hands jumped in and out of his hip pockets as he threw menacing looks at Old Hutchins, who hung limply in Mother Hutchins's arms. At the same time, a warm smell of fresh apple pie drifted in from the kitchen and made Rudy lick his lips hungrily, reminded him, even in the midst of his great anger, that it was nearly snack time. Now and then he glanced nervously out of the corner of his eye at his older brother Ben, who sat in a heavy oak chair in the corner near the treadle-operated sewing machine. But Ben never raised his eyes from his worn copy of Restless Guns. Note, Western novel, 1929, by William Colt MacDonald, 1891 to 1968. End of note. Rudy couldn't figure Ben. He kept tramping up and down the living room, from time to time knocking over a chair or breaking a lamp. Mother Hutchins and Old Hutchins inched back toward the bathroom. Rudy stopped suddenly and glared at them, then looked at Ben again. He just couldn't figure Ben. He couldn't figure any of them, but he could figure Ben even less than the others. He wanted Ben to notice him sometimes, but Ben always had his nose in a book. Ben read Zane Grey, Louis L'Amour, Ernest Haycox, Luke Short. Note. Prolific writers of Western novels and pulp stories. Zane Grey, 1872 to 1939. Louis L'Amour, 1908 to 1988. Ernest Haycox, 1899 to 1950. And Luke Short, pen name of Frederick Dilly Glidden, 1908 to 1975. End of note. Ben thought Zane Grey, Louis L'Amour, and Ernest Haycox were all right, but not as good as Luke Short. He thought Luke Short was the best of the lot. He'd read Luke Short's books 40 or 50 times. He had to have something to pass the time. Ever since his rigging had come loose 7 or 8 years ago when he was topping trees for Pacific Lumber, he'd had to have something to pass the time. Since then, he could only move the upper part of his body. Also, he seemed to have lost the power of speech. Anyway, he had never uttered a word since the day of the fall. But then he'd always been a quiet boy when he was living at home before. No bother at all. Still no bother, his mother maintained, if she was asked. Quiet as a mouse and needed very little seeing to. Besides, on the first of each month, Ben got a little disability check in the mail. Not much, but enough for them all to live on. Old Hutchins had quit work when the disability checks started coming. He didn't like his boss was the reason he gave at the time. Rudy had never left home. He'd never finished high school either. Ben had finished high school, but Rudy was a high school dropout. Now he was afraid of being drafted. The idea of being drafted made him very nervous. He didn't at all like the idea of being drafted. Mother Hutchins had always been a housewife and a homemaker. She was not very shrewd, but she knew how to make ends meet. Once in a while, though, if they ran short before the end of the month, she had to walk into town with a nice box of apples on her back and sell them for a dime each on the corner in front of Johnson's pharmacy. Mr. Johnson and the clerks knew her, and she always gave Mr. Johnson and the clerks a shiny red apple that she polished against the front of her dress. Rudy began making violent slashes and sword thrusts in the air, grunting as he gouged and chopped. He seemed to have forgotten about the old couple cowering in the passageway.
"Now, dear, don't you worry," Mother Hutchins said faintly to Old Hutchins. "Dr. Porter'll put you right. Why, a prostrate operation is an everyday occurrence. Look at Prime Minister Macmillan. Remember Prime Minister Macmillan, Daddy?
When he was prime minister and had his prostrate operation, he was up and around in no time.
Note. British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, 1894 to 1986, underwent surgery for an enlarged prostate on October 10, 1963, a day after he informed the Queen of his intention to resign as Prime Minister. End of note.
No time. Now you just cheer up. Why, shut up, shut up!
Rudy made a frightening lunge toward them, but they drew back farther into the narrow passageway. Fortunately, Mother Hutchins had enough strength left to whistle up Yeller, a shaggy giant of a dog who immediately ran into the room from the back porch and put his paws up on Rudy's narrow chest, pushing him back a step or two. Rudy retreated slowly, appalled at the dog's rank breath. On his way through the living room, he picked up old Hutchins's prized possession, an ashtray made from the hoof and foreleg of an elk, and hurled the smelly thing out into the garden. Old Hutchins began to cry again. His nerves were gone. Ever since Rudy's vicious attack upon his life a month ago, his nerves, which weren't good to begin with, had gone. What had happened was this. Old Hutchins was taking a bath when Rudy sneaked up and threw the RCA Victrola into the bathtub. It could have been serious, fatal even, if in his haste Rudy hadn't forgotten to plug it in. As it was, old Hutchins had received a bad bruise on his right thigh when the Victrola had made its flying entry through the open door. That was just after Rudy had seen a movie in town called Goldfinger. Note, third film in the James Bond series, released in 1964. End of note. Now they were more or less on guard at all moments, but especially whenever Rudy ventured into town. Who could tell what ideas he might pick up at the movies? He was very impressionable.
He's at a very impressionable age, Mother Hutchins said to old Hutchins.
Ben never said anything one way or the other. Nobody could figure Ben, not even his mother, Mother Hutchins. Rudy stayed in the barn just long enough to devour half the pie, then put a halter on Em, his favorite camel. He led her out the back door and safely through the elaborate network of snares, covered pits, and traps laid for the careless and the unwary. Once clear, he pulled Em's ear and commanded her to kneel, mounted, and was off. He clop-clopped out across the back 40, up into the dry, sage-covered foothills. He stopped once on a little rise to look back at the old homestead. He wished he had some dynamite and a plunger to blow it right off the landscape, like Lawrence of Arabia had done with those trains. He hated the sight of it, the old homestead. They were all crazy down there anyway. They wouldn't be missed. Would he miss them? No, he wouldn't miss them. Besides, there would still be the land, the apples. Damn the land and the apples anyway. He wished he had some dynamite. He turned Em into a dry arroyo. With the sun bearing down fiercely on his back, he cantered to the end of the Box Canyon. He stopped and dismounted and, behind a rock, uncovered the canvas that held the big Smith & Wesson service revolver, the burnous and the headgear. He dressed and then stuck the revolver in his sash. It fell out. He stuck it in again and it fell out again. Then he just decided to carry it in his hand, though it was heavy and it would be hard to guide him. It would call for a skillful bit of maneuvering on his part, but he thought he could do it. He thought he was up to it. Back at the farm, he left Em in the barn and made his way to the house. He saw the elk leg ashtray still in the garden, a few flies working away on it, and he sneered. The old man had been afraid to come out and retrieve it, but it gave him an idea. He burst in on them in the kitchen, old Hutchins sitting rather comfortably at the kitchen table and stirring his coffee and cream, looked completely stunned. Mother Hutchins was at the stove, putting in another pie.
Apples, 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 Rudy shrieked.
He followed this outburst with a wild laugh, waving his Colt 45 around in the air, then herded them into the living room. Ben looked up with a slight show of interest and then went back to his book.
It was Luke Short's Rawhide Trail.
This is it, Rudy said, his voice rising. This is it, this is it, this is it.
Mother Hutchins kept puckering her lips, almost as if expecting a kiss, trying to whistle up Yeller, but Rudy only laughed and hooted. He pointed at the window with the barrel of his Winchester.
There's Yeller,
he said. Mother Hutchins and Old Hutchins both looked to see Yeller trotting into the orchard with the ashtray in his mouth.
There's your old Yeller, Rudy said.
Old Hutchins groaned and fell with a painful clump to his knees. Mother Hutchins got down beside him but cast an imploring look in Rudy's direction. Rudy was about 4 feet away from her, just to the right of the red Naugahyde footstool.
Rudy, now you wouldn't do anything now, dear, you'd be sorry for later. You wouldn't hurt me or your pa, would you, Rudy? He ain't a pa to me, ain't, said Rudy, dancing around the living room with an occasional glance at Ben,
who since his initial momentary flicker of interest in the proceedings, hadn't stirred himself again.
Shouldn't say ain't, Rudy, Mother Hutchins gently reproved. Son, Old Hutchins stopped sniffling for a minute. You wouldn't hurt a poor old helpless broken-down old man with a prostrate condition, would you? Huh? Stick it out here, and I'll blow it off for you, Rudy said, waving the ugly snub-nosed barrel of his .38 right under Old Hutchins's rather large nose. I'll show you what I'll do for you. He waved it there from side to side a minute longer, then danced off again. No, I wouldn't shoot you. Shooting's too good for you.
But he fired a burst from the bar into the kitchen wall just to show them he meant business. Note. Bar. Browning automatic rifle. End of note. Ben raised his eyes. He had a soft, indolent look to his face. He stared at Rudy a minute without recognition, then went back to his book. He was in a fine room in a Virginia City hotel called the Palace. Downstairs, there were 3 or 4 angry men waiting for him at the bar, but right now he was going to enjoy the first bath he'd had in 3 months. Rudy faltered a minute, then looked around wildly. His eyes fell on the grandfather railroad tick-tock clock that had been in the family 7 years.
You see that clock there, Ma? When the big hand gets on the little hand, there's going to be an explosion. Wham! Foom! Up she goes, everything! Baloo!
With this, he bounded out the front door and jumped off the porch. He sat down behind an apple tree 100 yards from the house. He intended to wait until they were all assembled on the front porch, Mother Hutchins, Old Hutchins, even Ben, all assembled there with the few pitiful accumulations they hoped to preserve, and then he would pick them off quickly, one by one. He swept the porch with his scope, putting the crosshairs on the window, a wicker chair, a cracked flower pot drying in the sun on one of the porch steps. Then he took a long breath and settled down to wait. He waited and waited, but they didn't come. A small band of California mountain quail began to work their way down through the orchard, stopping every now and then to pick at a fallen apple or to look around the base of a tree for a nice juicy grub. He kept watching them and pretty soon was no longer watching the porch. He sat very still behind the tree, almost without breathing, and they didn't see him and came closer and closer, talking soft quail talk between themselves as they picked at the apples and sharply scrutinized the ground. He leaned forward slightly and strained his ears to overhear what they were saying. The quail were talking about Vietnam. It was too much for Rudy. He could have cried. He flapped his arms at the quail, said, "Who?" Ben, Vietnam, apples, prostrate. What did it all mean? Was there a connection between Marshall Dillon and James Bond? Odd Job and Captain Easy? If so, where did Luke Short fit it? And Ted Trueblood? His mind reeled. Note, Marshall Dillon. Marshall Matt Dillon, lead character in Gunsmoke, popular radio, 1952-61, and television, 1955-75, Western series. End of note. Note, Odd Job,
through Easy. Characters, respectively, in Goldfinger and the syndicated newspaper comic strip, Captain Easy, Soldier of Fortune, 1933-1988, created by cartoonist Roy Crane, 1901-1977. End of note. Note, Ted Trueblood, hunter, fisherman, and outdoorsman writer, 1913-1982, author of several handbooks, and a columnist and editor at Field & Stream magazine. End of note. With a last forlorn glance at the empty porch, he placed the shiny, recently blued barrels of the 12-gauge double into his mouth. From the Augustine Notebooks, October 11. "No way, sugar," she said, looking at him steadily. "No way at all, not on your life." He shrugged. He sipped from the glass of lemon fix without looking at her. "You must be crazy, it's true." She looked around at the other tables. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and at this time of year, there were not many tourists left on the island. Most of the tables in the courtyard were empty, and on some of the tables, waiters had stacked chairs. "Are you crazy? Is it really true, then?"
"Forget it," he said. "Let it alone."
A peacock had wandered in from the marketplace, which was next to the nearly empty courtyard where they sat at their table drinking the lemon fixes. The peacock stopped at a spigot near the edge of the courtyard and held its beak under the dripping tap. As it drank, its throat rippled up and down. Then the peacock walked slowly around some empty tables and headed in their direction. Halprin threw a wafer onto the flagstones. The bird picked it to bits there on the flagstones and ate the pieces without once looking up at them.
"You remind me of that peacock," he said.
She stood up and said, "I think you might just as well stay here. I think you've had it anyway. I think you've lost your mind. Why don't you just kill yourself and get it over with?" She waited a minute longer, holding her purse, and then she walked away between the empty tables. He signaled the waiter, who had watched everything. In a minute, the waiter put another bottle of lemon fix and a clean glass in front of him. After pouring what was left of her drink into his glass, the waiter took away her bottle and glass without saying anything. Halprin could see the bay and their ship from where he sat. The harbor was too shallow for a ship of its size to enter, so it had anchored a quarter mile out, behind the breakwater, and they had come ashore that morning on a tender. The entrance to the bay was narrow and had, more than 2,000 years ago, given rise to the legend that, in even more ancient days, the Colossus itself had straddled the entrance to the harbor, one mammoth bronze leg on either side of the harbor entrance. Some of the postcards for sale in the marketplace depicted a gigantic cartoon colossus with boats going and coming between its legs. In a little while, she came back to the table and sat down as if nothing had happened. Every day that passed, they hurt each other a little more. Every day now, they grew more used to wounding each other. At night, with this knowledge, their lovemaking had become vicious and unbridled, their bodies coming together like knives clashing in the dark. "You weren't serious, were you?" she said. "You didn't mean what you said? About staying here, you know, and all the rest."
"I don't know. Yes, I said it, didn't I? I'm serious about it."
She continued to look at him.
"How much money do you have?" he asked.
"Not a cent. Nothing. You have everything, sugar. You're carrying it all. I can't believe this has happened to me, but I don't even have enough to buy cigarettes."
"I'm sorry. Well," he said after a minute, "if we just wouldn't look or act or even talk like broken-down Hemingway characters. That's what I'm afraid of," he said.
She laughed. "Jesus, if that's all you're afraid of," she said. "You have your typewriter," she said.
"That's true. And they must sell paper here, and pens or pencils. Here's a pen, for instance. I have a pen right here in my pocket."
He scribbled some sharp vertical lines on the paper coaster.
"It works." He grinned for the first time.
"How long would it take?"
she said and waited. I don't have any idea. Maybe 6 months, maybe longer. I've known people who... probably longer. I've never done it before, as you know. He drank from his glass and didn't look at her. His breathing had slowed. I don't think we can make it, she said. I don't think we have it in us.
Frankly, I don't think we do either, he said. I'm not asking or forcing you to stay. The ship won't leave for another 5 or 6 hours. You can make up your mind before that. You don't have to stay. I'll divide up the money, of course. I'm sorry about that. I don't want you to stay unless you're sure you want to stay. But I think I will stay. My life is half over, more than half over. The only really extraordinary thing to happen to me in, I don't know, years, was to fall in love with you. That's the only really extraordinary thing in years. That other life is over now, and there's no going back. I don't believe in gestures, not since I was a kid, before I married Christina. But this would be a gesture of some sort, I suppose. Call it that if you want. That is, if I pull it off. But I think I might, if I stay. I know it sounds crazy. I don't know, though, about us. I'd like you to stay. You know what you mean to me. But you must do what's right for you from now on. In my more lucid moments... He turned the glass in his hand. I think it's true. It's over for us. Why, just look at me. My hands are shaking, for Christ's sake. He put his hands out over the table so she could see. He shook his head. In any case, there's somebody out there waiting for you, if you want to go.
Just like you were waiting.
Yes, just like I was waiting, that's true.
I want to stay, she said after a minute. If it doesn't work, if it isn't going to work, we'll know. We'll be able to see in a little while, a week or two. I can always go then.
Anytime, he said. I won't try to hold you.
You will, she said. If I decide to go one way or another, you'll try to hold me. You'll do that.
They watched a flock of pigeons turn with a rush of wings overhead and then wheel toward the ship.
Let's go for it then, she said and touched the back of his left hand where it held his glass. His right hand was in his lap, clenched. You stay, I'll stay. We'll both stay together, okay? Then we'll see. Sugar?
Okay, he said.
He got up from the table and sat down again.
Okay, then.
His breathing was all right once more.
I'll speak to someone about getting our stuff off the ship and applying for a refund for the rest of the trip. Then I'll divide all the money between us. We'll divide the money today. We'll both feel better about that. We'll get a hotel for tonight, divide the money, and then look for a place tomorrow. But you're probably right, you know. I am crazy. Sick and crazy.
He was serious as he said this. She began to cry. He stroked her hand and felt tears come to his own eyes. He took her hands. She nodded slowly as the tears continued to run from her eyes. The waiter turned his back on them abruptly.
He moved to the sink and after a minute began to wash and dry some glasses and hold them up to the light. A thin, mustached man with carefully combed hair. Halpern recognized him from the ship. The man had boarded with them at Piraeus. Pulled out a chair and sat down at one of the empty tables. He hung his jacket over the back of one of the chairs, rolled the cuffs of his sleeves back once, and lighted a cigarette. He looked briefly in their direction. Halpern was still holding her hands, she was still crying, and then looked away. The waiter arranged a small white towel over his arm and went over to the man. At the edge of the courtyard, the peacock turned its head slowly from side to side and regarded them all with cold, brilliant eyes.
October 18. He sipped coffee and remembered beginnings. Imagine, he thought, and the next time he looked, it was clearly noon. The house was quiet. He got up from the table and went to the door. Women's voices carried in from the street. Flowers of all kinds grew around the steps, big puffy flowers, drooping red and yellow flowers mainly, with a few shapely purple ones as well. He shut the door and headed down the street for cigarettes.
He didn't whistle, but he let his arms swing as he moved down the steep, cobbled street. The sun fell squarely off the sides of the white buildings and made him squint. Augustine. What else? Simple. No diminutive, either, ever. He had never called her anything but Augustine. He kept walking. He nodded at men, women, and horses alike. He drew aside the bead curtains over the door and went inside. The young barman, Michael, wearing a black armband, was leaning on his elbows on the bar, a cigarette between his lips, talking to George Varos. Varos was a fisherman who had lost his left hand in an accident. He still went out now and then, but since he was unable to handle the nets, he said he no longer felt right going out in the boats. He spent his days selling sesame rolls that looked like donuts. Two broomsticks stacked with sesame rolls leaned against the counter next to Varos. The men looked at him and nodded. "Cigarettes and a lemon fix, please," he said to Michael. He took the cigarettes and his drink to a small table near the window where he could see the bay. Two small boats moved up and down with the motion of the waves. The men in the boats sat staring down into the water without moving or talking, while the boats moved up and down on the waves. He sipped the drink and smoked, and in a little while he took the letter out of his pocket and commenced to read. Now and then he stopped and looked out the window at the boats. The men at the counter went on talking. "That's a start, for sure," she said. She had put her arms around his shoulders, her breasts just grazing his back. She was reading what he had written. "It's not bad, sugar," she said. "No, it's not bad at all. But where was I when this was taking place? Was this yesterday?"
"What do you mean?" He glanced over the pages. "You mean this? The house was quiet? Maybe you were asleep, I don't know. Or out shopping, I don't know. Is it important? All I say is, the house was quiet. I don't need to go into your whereabouts right now."
"I never nap in the morning, or in the middle of the day either, for that matter." She made a face at him.
"I don't think I have to account in this for your whereabouts at every minute. Do you think? What the hell?"
"No, I mean, I'm not making anything out of it. I mean, it's just strange, you know, that's what I mean." She waved her hand at the pages. "You know what I mean."
He got up from the table and stretched and looked out the window at the bay.
"Do you want to work some more?" she said. "Lord, we don't have to go to the beach. That was just a suggestion. I'd rather see you work some more if that's what you want."
She had been eating an orange. He could smell the orange on her breath as she leaned over the table and looked seriously at the pages once more. She grinned and ran her tongue over her lips.
"Well," she said.
"So, well, well." He said, "I want to go to the beach. That's enough for today. That's enough for now, anyway. Maybe tonight I'll do something. I'll fool around with this tonight, maybe. I've started, that's the main thing. I'm the compulsive type. I'll go on now. Maybe it'll work itself out. Let's go to the beach."
She grinned again. "Good," she said. She put her hand on his cock. "Good, good, good. How is our little friend today?" She stroked his cock through his trousers. "I'd hoped you'd start today," she said. "I thought you might today for some reason, I don't know why. Let's go then. I'm happy today, this minute. I can't tell you. It's as if I feel happier today than I've felt in a long, long time. Maybe."
"Let's not think maybe or anything," he said. He reached under the halter and touched her breast, took the nipple between his fingers and rolled it back and forth. "We'll take one day at a time, that's what we decided. One day, then the next day, then the next."
The nipple began to stiffen under his fingers. "When we come back from swimming, we'll do things to each other," she said. "Unless, of course, you want to put off swimming until later."
"I'm easy," he said. "Then, no, wait. I'll put my trunks on. When we're at the beach, maybe we'll tell each other about what we're going to do to each other when we get back here. Let's go ahead and go to the beach now while the sun's out. It may rain. Let's go ahead and go."
She began to hum something as she put some oranges into a little bag. Halprin slipped on his trunks.
He put the sheets of paper and the ballpoint pen into the cupboard. He stared into the cupboard a minute and then, the humming gone, turned slowly. She stood in front of the open door in her shorts and halter, the long black hair hanging down over her shoulders from under the white straw sun hat. She held the oranges and the straw-covered water bottle against her breasts. She looked at him a minute, and then she winked, grinned, and cocked her hip. His breath went out of him, and his legs felt weak. For a minute, he was afraid of another seizure. He saw the wedge of blue sky behind her, and the darker blue, shining blue water of the bay, the small waves rising and falling. He closed his eyes and opened them. She was still there, grinning. "What we do matters, brother," he remembered Miller saying long ago. There came to him an empty tugging in his stomach. Then he felt his jaws simply tighten of their own accord until he ground his teeth and felt his face might tell her things he himself didn't yet know. He felt lightheaded, but all senses on the alert. He could smell the broken orange in the room, could hear a fly drone and then bump the window near the bed. He heard flowers around the steps, their long stems moving against each other in the warm breeze. Gulls called and waves rose and then fell on the beach. He felt at the edge of something. It was as if things he had never understood before might now suddenly be made clear to him.
"Crazy about you," he said. "Crazy about you, baby. Baby."
She nodded.
"Close the door," he said.
His cock began to rise against the swimming trunks. She put her things on the table and pushed the door shut with her foot. Then she took off her hat and shook her hair.
"Well, well, well," she said and grinned again. "Well, let me say hello to our friend," she said. "Not so little friend."
Her eyes shone as she moved toward him and her voice had become languorous. "Lie down," she said, "and don't move. Just lie down on the bed. And don't move. Don't move here." Kindling. It was the middle of August, and Myers was between lives. The only thing different about this time from the other times was that this time he was sober. He'd just spent 28 days at a drying out facility. But during this period, his wife took it into her head to go down the road with another drunk, a friend of theirs. The man had recently come into some money and had been talking about buying into a bar and restaurant in the eastern part of the state. Myers called his wife, but she hung up on him. She wouldn't even talk to him, let alone have him anywhere near the house. She had a lawyer and a restraining order. So he took a few things, boarded a bus, and went to live near the ocean in a room in a house owned by a man named Saul, who had run an ad in the paper. Saul was wearing jeans and a red t-shirt when he opened the door. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and Myers had just gotten out of a cab. Under the porch light, Myers could see that Saul's right arm was shorter than his other arm, and the hand and fingers were withered. He didn't offer either his good left hand or his withered hand for Myers to shake, and this was fine with Myers. Myers felt plenty rattled as it was. "You just called, right?" Saul said. "You're here to see the room. Come on in." Myers gripped his suitcase and stepped inside. "This is my wife. This is Bonnie," Saul said. Bonnie was watching TV, but moved her eyes to see who it was coming inside. She pushed the button on a device she held in her hand, and the volume went off. She pushed it again, and the picture disappeared. Then she got up off the sofa, onto her feet. She was a fat girl. She was fat all over, and she huffed when she breathed. "I'm sorry it's so late," Myers said. "Nice to meet you." "It's all right," Bonnie said. "Did my husband tell you on the phone what we're asking?" Myers nodded. He was still holding the suitcase. "Well, this is the living room," Saul said, "as you can see for yourself." He shook his head and brought the fingers of his good hand up to his chin. "I may as well tell you that we're new at this. We never rented a room to anybody before. But it's just back there not being used, and we thought, what the hell? A person can always use a little extra."
I don't blame you a bit, Myers said. Where are you from? Bonnie said. You're not from anywhere around town.
My wife wants to be a writer, Saul said. Who, what, where, why, and how much?
I just got here, Myers said. He moved the suitcase to his other hand. I got off the bus about an hour ago, read your ad in the paper, and called up.
What sort of work do you do? Bonnie wanted to know.
I've done everything, Myers said. He set the suitcase down and opened and closed his fingers. Then he picked up the suitcase again. Bonnie didn't pursue it. Saul didn't either, though Myers could see he was curious.
Myers took in a photograph of Elvis Presley on top of the TV. Elvis's signature ran across the breast of his white sequined jacket. He moved a step closer. The king, Bonnie said.
Myers nodded but didn't say anything. Alongside the picture of Elvis was a wedding picture of Saul and Bonnie. In the picture, Saul was dressed up in a suit and tie. Saul's good, strong left arm reached around Bonnie's waist as far as it would go. Saul's right hand and Bonnie's right hand were joined over Saul's belt buckle. Bonnie wasn't going anywhere if Saul had anything to say about it. Bonnie didn't mind. In the picture, Bonnie wore a hat and was all smiles.
I love her, Saul said, as if Myers had said something to the contrary.
How about that room you were going to show me, Myers said.
I knew there was something we were forgetting, Saul said.
They moved out of the living room into the kitchen. Saul first, then Myers, carrying his suitcase, and then Bonnie. They passed through the kitchen and turned left, just before the back door. There were some open cupboards along the wall, and a washer and dryer. Saul opened a door at the end of the little corridor and turned on the light in the bathroom. Bonnie moved up and huffed and said, "This is your private bathroom. That door in the kitchen is your own entrance." Saul opened the door to the other side of the bathroom and turned on another light. "This is the room," he said.
"I made up the bed with clean sheets," Bonnie said. "But if you take the room, you'll have to be responsible from here on out."
"Like my wife says, this is not a hotel," Saul said. "But you're welcome if you want to stay." There was a double bed against one wall, along with a nightstand and lamp, a chest of drawers, a pinochle table with a metal chair. A big window gave out onto the backyard. Myers put his suitcase on the bed and moved to the window. He raised the shade and looked out. A moon rode high in the sky. In the distance, he could see a forested valley and mountain peaks. Was it his imagination, or did he hear a stream or a river?
"I hear water," Myers said.
"That's the little Quilcene River you hear," Saul said. "That river has the fastest per foot drop to it of any river in the country."
"Well, what do you think?" Bonnie said. She went over and turned down the covers on the bed, and this simple gesture almost caused Myers to weep.
"I'll take it," Myers said. "I'm glad," Saul said. "My wife's glad, too, I can tell. I'll have them pull that out of the paper tomorrow. You want to move in right now, don't you?"
"That's what I hoped," Myers said.
"We'll let you get settled," Bonnie said. "I gave you two pillows, and there's an extra quilt in that closet." Myers could only nod.
"Well, good night," Saul said.
"Good night," Bonnie said.
"Good night," Myers said, "and thank you."
Saul and Bonnie went through his bathroom and into the kitchen. They closed the door, but not before Myers heard Bonnie say, "He seems okay."
"Pretty quiet," Saul said.
"I think I'll fix buttered popcorn."
"I'll eat some with you," Saul said.
Pretty soon Myers heard the TV come on again in the living room, but it was a very faint sound and he didn't think it would bother him. He opened the window all the way and heard the sound of the river as it raced through the valley on its way to the ocean. He took his things out of the suitcase and put them away in the drawers. Then he used the bathroom and brushed his teeth. He moved the table so that it sat directly in front of the window. Then he looked at where she'd turned the covers down. He drew out the metal chair and sat down and took a ballpoint out of his pocket. He thought for a minute, then opened the notebook, and at the top of a blank white page he wrote the words, "Emptiness is the beginning of all things." He stared at this and then he laughed. "Jesus, what rubbish." He shook his head. He closed the notebook, undressed, and turned off the light. He stood for a moment, looking out the window and listening to the river. Then he moved to get into bed. Bonnie fixed the popcorn, salted it, and poured butter over it, and took it in a big bowl to where Saul was watching TV. She let him help himself to some first. He used his left hand to good effect, and then he reached his little hand over for the paper towel she offered. She took a little popcorn for herself. "What do you make of him?" she wanted to know, our new roomer. Saul shook his head and went on watching TV and eating popcorn. Then, as if he'd been thinking about her question, he said, "I like him all right. He's okay. But I think he's on the run from something." "What?" "I don't know what. I'm just guessing. He isn't dangerous, and he isn't going to make any trouble." "His eyes," Bonnie said. "What about his eyes?" "They're sad eyes. Saddest eyes I ever saw on a man." Saul didn't say anything for a minute. He finished his popcorn. He wiped his fingers and dabbed his chin with the paper towel. "He's okay. He's just had some trouble along the way, that's all. No disgrace attached to that. Give me a sip of that, will you?" He reached over for the glass of orange drink she was holding and took some. "You know, I forgot to collect the rent from him tonight. I'll have to get it in the morning if he's up. And I should have asked him how long he intends to stay. Damn, what's wrong with me? I don't want to turn this place into a hotel." "You couldn't think of everything. Besides, we're new at this. We never rented a room out before." Bonnie decided she was going to write about the man in the notebook she was filling up. She closed her eyes and thought about what she was going to write. "This tall, stooped, but handsome, curly-headed stranger with sad eyes walked into our house one fateful night in August." She leaned into Saul's left arm and tried to write some more. Saul squeezed her shoulder, which brought her back to the present. She opened her eyes and closed them, but she couldn't think of anything else to write about him at the moment. "Time will tell," she thought. She was glad he was here. "This show's for the birds," Saul said. "Let's go to bed. We have to get up in the morning." In bed, Saul loved her up, and she took him and held him and loved him back. But all the time she was doing it, she was thinking about the big curly-headed man in the back room. What if he suddenly opened the bedroom door and looked in on them? "Saul," she said, "is this bedroom door locked?" "What? Be still," Saul said. Then he finished and rolled off, but he kept his little arm on her breast. She lay on her back and thought for a minute. Then she patted his fingers, let air out through her mouth, and went off to sleep thinking about blasting caps, which is what had gone off in Saul's hand when he was a teenager, severing nerves and causing his arm and fingers to wither. Bonnie began to snore. Saul took her arm and shook it until she turned over on her side, away from him. In a minute, he got up and put on his underwear. He went into the living room. He didn't turn on the light. He didn't need a light. The moon was out, and he didn't want a light. He went from the living room into the kitchen. He made sure the back door was locked, and then he stood for a while outside the bathroom door listening, but he couldn't hear anything out of the ordinary. The faucet dripped. It needed a washer, but then it had always dripped. He went back through the house and closed and locked their bedroom door. He checked the clock and made sure the stem was pulled. He got into bed and moved right up against Bonnie. He put his leg over her leg, and in that way, he finally went to sleep. These three people slept and dreamed, while outside the house the moon grew large and seemed to move across the sky until it was out over the ocean and growing smaller and paler. In his dream, someone is offering Myers a glass of scotch, but just as he is about to take it, reluctantly, he wakes up in a sweat, his heart racing. Saul dreams that he is changing a tire on a truck and that he has the use of both of his arms. Bonnie dreams she is taking three children to the park. She even has names for the children. She named them just before the trip to the park: Millicent, Dion, and Randy. Randy keeps wanting to pull away from her and go his own way. Soon, the sun breaks over the horizon, and birds begin calling to each other. The little Quilcene River rushes down through the valley, shoots under the highway bridge, rushes another 100 yards over sand and sharp rocks, and pours into the ocean. An eagle flies down from the valley and over the bridge and begins to pass up and down the beach. A dog barks. At this minute, Saul's alarm goes off. Myers stayed in his room that morning until he heard them leave. Then he went out and made instant coffee. He looked in the fridge and saw that one of the shelves had been cleared for him. A little sign was scotch-taped to it. Mr. Myers' shelf. Later, he walked a mile toward town to a little service station he remembered from the night before that also sold a few groceries. He bought milk, cheese, bread, and tomatoes. That afternoon, before it was time for them to come home, he left the rent money and cash on the table and went back into his own room. Late that night, before going to bed, he opened his notebook and on a clean page he wrote, "Nothing." He adjusted his schedule to theirs. Mornings he'd stay in the room until he heard Saul in the kitchen making coffee and getting his breakfast. Then he would hear Saul calling Bonnie to get up, and then they'd have breakfast, but they wouldn't talk much. Then Saul would go out to the garage and start the pickup, back out, and drive away. In a little while, Bonnie's ride would pull up in front of the house, a horn would toot, and Bonnie would say, every time, "I'm coming." It was then that Myers would go out to the kitchen, put on water for coffee, and eat a bowl of cereal. But he didn't have much of an appetite. The cereal and coffee would keep him for most of the day, until the afternoon when he'd eat something else, a sandwich, before they arrived home, and then he'd stay out of the kitchen for the rest of the time when they might be in there or in the living room watching TV. He didn't want any conversation. She'd go into the kitchen for a snack the first thing after she got in from work. Then she'd turn on the TV and wait until Saul came in, and then she'd get up and fix something for the two of them to eat. They might talk on the telephone to friends, or else go sit outside in the backyard between the garage and Myers' bedroom window and talk about their day and drink iced tea until it was time to go inside and turn on the TV. Once he heard Bonnie say to someone on the telephone, "How'd she expect me to pay any attention to Elvis Presley's weight when my own weight was out of control at the time?" They'd said he was welcome any time to sit in the living room with them and watch TV. He'd thanked them but said no, television hurt his eyes.